This is Kathy Keenholtz speaking on June 14th at 8 o'clock with Leo Steinberg, and we can begin. It's on.
Well, as I was saying before we began, far more important if the objective is to compose an oral history of the hunter-gatherer would be interviews with Eugene Goosen, mm-hmm. who ran the art department, and was very creative about it, and of course William Rubin. I suspect that Bill will be very happy to talk to you about it. It was in fact through Bill that I got into Hunter College.
Now you started there, it was in 61, wasn't it?
It was either 61 or 62, but you probably, they must not remember, because it's too long ago for me to remember. You looked it up, and it was 61. And it happened in this manner. I got a call from Bill Rubin, who was holding down two jobs at the time. He was teaching at Sarah Lawrence and at Hunter College. And he didn't want to let either of them go. There were reasons he wanted to teach, mm-hmm. to continue teaching at Sarah Lawrence, and there were good reasons he wanted to continue at Hunter, but not full time. So he called me shortly after I graduated from the Institute of Fine Arts and asked whether I would be interested in a half-time job. Mm-hmm. And I said that was exactly what I would like. Because it would give me time to do my own work. Okay. And I knew that if I were to teach full time, I would not be able to get anything else done. And I was quite willing to take the sacrifice to earn half pay. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Bill had said to Edna Lutz, who was then the chairman, that he wanted to go on half time. And as an inducement, he said to her, if I can find somebody just as good as myself to take over the other half of the year, would you be interested? And Edna Lutz said, well, if you can find somebody as good as yourself, sure. So that was the flattery which he tried to seduce me into it, but it didn't take much seduction. I was delighted. And that's how I got into Hunter, half time. And I had my interview with Edna Lutz, whom I had not met before. She had read some of my scattered writing, so she knew more or less what I could do, and offered me an associate professorship right away, which was rather nice. It was a starting point.
Exactly, that's a high compliment.
And, well, that was in the good old days. Nowadays, you'd be starting as an adjunct, continue as an adjunct for 11 years before they fire you. And that's how I got into Hunter. Eventually Bill left because he was going on to bigger things, as you know. Mm-hmm. Both the Museum of Modern Art and the Institute of Fine Arts. Okay. And I was asked whether I would go full-time, but I hung on to my contract. I'm also told, I was told at one time, that some people thought it was rather irregular to hire somebody to teach half-time. There were no precedents for this at Hunter. Mm-hmm. But it was Minna Reese, the most remarkable woman. Mm. You know of her.
Yes.
Where she founded the Graduate Center,
yes.
Later.
Yes.
At that time,
the library is now named after her.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. She was an extraordinary woman. The way she ran faculty meetings, I've never seen such efficiency. Not a word was wasted, and somehow she managed to discipline the entire faculty. They knew that she wanted efficiency, and nobody was bullshitting. Things really got done. Well, I'm told that it was Minna Reese who said, when my appointment came up, that if this is a good person, then let's take him on the terms we can get him.
Okay.
And had it not been for her flexibility, called an imaginative approach to education. I think hopefully I wouldn't have got that deal. Anyhow, I
hung on to that. So you came in full-time or were you still part-time?
No, I came in half-time and I insisted on maintaining that
okay.
half-time contract throughout my 12 years at Hunter.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
That meant I was hired as an associate professor at an opening salary of $12,000 a year, of which I took half. And it meant that all my benefits and so on, everything was half, but I was happy to make that sacrifice for the client. I recently read that, what's his name? Trying to remember, he's a well-known Harvard psychologist. Harvard, I'll think of their name in a minute. Anyway, he said that there are three reasons why people went into academia.
Uh-huh.
They were June, July, August. So, anyway, that you asked whether this was my first teaching.
Well, I gather you graduated from the Institute in 1960, and since I had assumed it was the first teaching job that you
had. The first regular teaching job. I actually began giving lectures before I began to study art history at the YMHA.
What does that stand for?
Pardon?
I'm not sure what that stands for, YMHA.
Young Men's Hebrew Association. Or they call it the 92nd Street Y.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
It's YM and YWHA, Young Men and Women. And so that's why I've got my training in lecturing to very small audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was teaching life drawing at Parsons School of Design at the time.
Okay.
And I invited the director or president of Parsons to come and hear one of my lectures at the Y. And as a result of that, I was asked to give the five art history lectures that were then being given to the students at Parsons School of Design.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you had taught art, you went to the Slade School.
Oh, yes,
art.
It's in the 1930s, from 1936 to 40.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I did art history lectures at Parsons School of Design, but as I look back on it, I'm kind of embarrassed to remember it. they were sprightly, but I think very unprofessional.
Uh-huh.
And I really went to the Institute in order to give myself some kind of solid foundation.
Yeah, that happened after the Parsons
mm-hmm.
lecturing. Okay.
Yes, I went to the Institute at age, I think, 35 or 36.
Okay.
And I was determined to get my two things before I was 40, a doctorate and a driver's license. And I almost made it because I didn't get my driver's license until a few months after my 40th birthday.
But the fact you got your doctorate in 5 years is quite impressive.
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm told that I was the second fastest to get it. Went all the way from the BA to the doctorate in 5.5 years.
Oh, you went through for the BA as well at the same time?
Well, that was... No, I got that before. It was... That's another story, it's not interesting. It's kind of phony degree, just so that I would be able to get into graduate school.
I see.
Phyllis Boba was the one who did it in 5 years.
Okay.
And that was supposed to be a record. And I came second in 5.5 years. So, in a way, it was my first regular teaching job in art history at Hunter College. And Edna Lutz was chairperson. And what recollections do I have of her?
Yes.
I think she was a sort of mother hen. She loved the department, she loved the work, she loved the students, and as far as I could tell, she loved all the faculty and indiscriminately both the studio people and the art historians,
mm-hmm.
which is very rare.
Well, she came out of the theater department.
I don't know. But I never knew her well.
Mm-hmm.
She retired very soon after I began to teach, and then Eugene Goossen took over.
Yeah.
And not long afterwards, I think she died. I do remember writing her a letter at her retirement, but I had very little contact with her otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I must tell you that about the department as such, I don't have very much to say because I didn't take that much interest in the department.
Mm-hmm.
The people like William Rubin, I mean, he was really concerned with hiring the right people and sort of promoting a program. And of course, Eugene Goossen, building the studio department, he wanted it to be the best in the nation. And he went after artists whose work he really admired.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get the Hunter Art Department written up. Had a lot of publicity, but there were some famous people teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Motherwell had been a great influence on Edna Lutz, but that was before my time.
Okay.
Motherwell never turned up after my time. I remember, I think, Baziotis was teaching, yeah. and then for a while Rothko was teaching.
He did, yes. He taught there for a mm-hmm. bit. I don't know if Tony Smith was there.
Tony Smith
there?
Was
yeah.
very much there
yeah.
in my time. As a matter of fact, since none of the studio people would ever think of attending one of my lectures, which I was giving at the Metropolitan Museum, I asked Tony Smith, because he was friendly with him, to come, and he did come to one of my lectures. And then he insisted on wanting to give me one of his sculptures, but he never got around to it.
I don't know if it would fit. I imagine he did smaller things, but
yes, he would have given me one of his maquettes, smaller things, but I never got one. I gave a lecture about Tony Smith in, was it at Yale or at Hartford? I can't remember now. He had a show,
mm-hmm.
and the show wasn't arousing any particular interest in the community. And so the man who organized the show became well known as a curator and collector. He's dead now.
Mm-hmm.
Forget his name. That's what you get for interviewing old men. They don't use proper names anymore. anyway, he called me and asked whether I would give a lecture on Tony Smith to perhaps generate some interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And then I asked Tony to come to one of my lectures. Otherwise, there was very little contact between the art history people and the studio. The studio, of course, were the predominant force.
Mm-hmm. I hear it's a little better now. You're required to take courses as a studio major in criticism, in art criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So there the two groups tend to mix. However, it is something of the same way.
Yeah, well, it's a well-known thing, and it's very questionable whether art history and studio art should be under one roof in many universities and colleges, as at University of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
After Hunter, they're quite separate from each other. And there are, of course, art historians who take a keen interest in contemporary art and in artists. My good friend Al Elson just died a few months ago, who was very interested
mm-hmm.
in going to artist studios, meeting with them. And I know several such art historians, but they're not typical.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know some artists who are willing to go to a museum and even look at old master paintings, but they're not typical either.
Do you think the two should be together?
Do I think they should be together?
You have a unique perspective, seeing as you you've done both.
Well,
you've seen both
they
sides.
Do very, very different things. See, their minds are in different places. If you do art history, right now I'm finishing a book which has involved me deeply in theology. And I've been reading early Christian medieval theologians
mm-hmm.
and some Renaissance theologians. You couldn't be further removed from concerns of contemporary artists.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens very often if you get somebody like Mary Moore, whose field is Greek vase painting. She might have much more in common with people in classics, classical literature,
exactly.
in mythology, anthropology, any field, rather than contemporary art, than art making now.
Mm-hmm.
See.
Now,
so
you mentioned that you brought her into the department. She was one of the
yes.
people.
Yes. So I was always trying to bring professional art historians in, and this was sometimes a source of conflict. And when I knew that a well-trained art historian was available, I would recommend them.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did that with Dick Staperford and also with Janet Cox Rearick.
Okay.
I was very moralistic in those days about maintaining real standards. I'm also told that I intimidated people and probably alienated or antagonized people. I think being that kind of a moralist is not the way to make friends and influence people. So
Dale Carnegie would not have.
Mm-hmm. So when I left Honda, I don't think there was much regret on anybody's part.
Seems to have been erased. You know, some of your students are now teaching there.
Well, Lisa Vergara, anybody else?
Well, I have thought, Jane Roos went through the Hunter program.
Mm.
Her name is Jane Roos.
I don't remember her.
Okay.
Was she a student of mine?
She studied at Hunter,
mm-hmm.
And about the same time as Lisa Vergara. So
I don't remember. Lisa, of course, did her master's thesis with me,
mm-hmm.
and we remained in contact, even when she was writing a dissertation. And when she had to defend her dissertation at Columbia many years later, she asked for me to be invited. And I wanted to go to protect her in case she needed protection, because I knew that she had evolved a rather imaginative and personal approach
uh-huh.
to the problem of symbolism in Rubens landscapes. She had decided and I think was able to prove that Rubens landscapes were ahead of her heels. No, that's the wrong, that's a mixed metaphor. Up to the sky in symbolism.
Mm.
And she really had to work out her own methodology for it. So I thought she might come under heavy fire. But to my great delight, I didn't have to say a word. They were at Columbia. They were very respectful of her and full of admiration. So.
Oh,
and then she published a very good book. Anyway, I was proud of Lisa. And she paid me back in a way, because when she was asked by the professors at Columbia how she first came to the subject, she said, there was one remark that I had made during a lecture on Rubens, etc., of thinking about him. I apparently had said something like, that Rubens' vision is so comprehensive, he can get day and night into one picture at the same time. And that intrigued her sufficiently to start looking at Rubens' landscapes.
Hmm.
And actually, that's the highest kind of flattery a teacher can get. See, if one remark like that could set you off.
Well, you taught mostly, from what the records show, you taught mostly Baroque art, Southern Baroque. Then you taught research methods.
But I also taught the general surveys for quite a few years.
Okay.
I remember teaching them in in a huge auditorium to hundreds of students. And at that time, Lehman College had not yet been named. It was not yet independent. It was Hunter College in the Bronx.
Yeah.
I used to have to go up there. I was teaching in the Bronx as well. And I can't remember what courses I taught, but I had majored in Baroque art, so it's quite likely that I was teaching Baroque and methods. I don't remember what else I taught.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I know that I taught a Mantegna course, and it was the first Mantegna course ever taught in America. Creighton Gilbert, some years later, told me that he decided to teach a Mantegna course, mm-hmm. and I felt very one-upsman. What is the phrase? I said, oh, it's been done.
Yeah, I'd always associated you with Renaissance or perhaps modern art.
I tell you, when we at the Institute in the 1950s, when I was there, you had to take one major, one related minor, and one unrelated minor. And my major was Baroque art.
Mm-hmm.
My related minor was Renaissance art. My unrelated minor was ancient art, all of it. And I was very much involved with ancient Egypt. I don't know if I ever taught a course on it at Hunter.
It's a heavy course load.
I no longer remember what I was teaching at Hunter, although I suspect that I still have my course notes
mm-hmm.
somewhere. But they will never be available to anyone. They will be destroyed. Now, did you, shall we look at your next question?
I have two others.
What was the structure of the art department at the time? Who taught what? What were you asked to teach? About the structure of the art department, I think Goosen can tell you better.
Okay.
And Bill Rubin will tell you better. All I know is that it was the studio department and then a small art department. And I think we felt somewhat orphaned. Because we couldn't even get the windows, the proper blinds for the windows. So that when you taught a course during daylight hours, the lights didn't show up. I got so angry with this, I said, if those blinds are not here by next week, I'm going to bring in pots of black paint and brushes, and we're going to paint all the window panes black. I think that did it.
So who was teaching with you at the time? Who was there?
I think you'll have to consult the records.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I know that Janet Cotterer came in towards the end of my period of teaching. Eunice Lipton was teaching for a while. Dick Staperford, I think I helped him get in too. He was a Krauthammer student, and he's still teaching there.
Yes.
Yes.
Of all of them, I believe Janet Cox-Rear has been there the longest, the present faculty.
Yes.
And then I gather Mary Moore came in.
Mm-hmm. There was another woman, young woman, who taught ancient art, and I had to observe her, and unfortunately I decided that she was wrong for us, and that is also the most painful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I did it two or three times, and I had to give a negative judgment, but I was considered the senior art historian there.
Okay.
And what were you asked to teach, apart from having to teach the survey courses at the very beginning of my teaching career there? I don't think I was ever asked to teach anything.
Mm-hmm.
think I just announced what I wanted to teach. That is my recollection, but perhaps I'm retrojecting from my later experience at Penn. I can't remember.
Well, if you came in, what was Bill Rubin teaching? Did you come in and take over his curriculum as well as his place on the faculty?
I know that I also taught modern.
Okay.
I know I taught Picasso at one time. And
now, you were telling me there's an interesting story with you starting to teach drawing.
Yeah, but that happened fairly late, because whenever Goosen and I had lunch, sooner or later I'd be drawing something on a napkin or a tabletop. Whenever he had a class to teach after me, he would find my drawings on the blackboard. And because I had a certain academic skill in drawing, I had gone to the Slade in London, and had learned the kind of draftsmanship which is no longer being taught.
Mm-hmm.
You were all trying to draw like anger in those days.
Yeah.
And so Goosen asked me to teach life drawing, which I was delighted to do, and for a number of reasons. I like drawing, and I like teaching drawing. And I like the fact that you didn't have to prepare lectures, you didn't have to read student papers.
Mm-hmm.
It was extraordinarily easy compared to preparing art history classes. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed that very much. But I think I also felt that the times had changed, and the kind of drawing that I could teach was really not of great interest to the students.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jean Goosen was building up the department to emphasize abstraction.
Yes, abstraction, so. And then conceptual art and so on. And close observation. I mean, the kinds of things that I would say to students, I would find students drawing fast and mechanically repeating their lines, drawing repeating ovals for the head and so on,
mm-hmm.
never looking at the specificity of that particular head, at that particular angle, in that particular light, just, and I had a feeling that they were drawing what they already knew, you know, just exercising a sort of manual habit.
Mm-hmm.
And if the model happened to have arms, they would only draw the arms down to the wrists.
Hands
and I would say, pardon?
Hands are tough.
And what?
Hands are tough to do. Yeah.
Yes. I know why hands are tough to do. Hands are tough to do because there's so many joints in them. And wherever you have a joint, you're likely to have a change of direction. And when you're, excuse me, when you're dealing with the whole body, there are only a few joints. There's one at the neck, and then one at the shoulders, and the elbows, and the waist, and groin, and knees. And you get a lot of mileage out of that. See? You get very little mileage out of drawing a hand. And yet, if you look at the hands, you multiply the number of joints in it, almost as many joints in the hand as in all the rest of the body. And that doesn't seem to pay. So they leave the hands off, and I would say to the student, what about the hands? And the student would say, well, I'm just going for the essentials. And I would say, your hands are not essential to you? And then I would point out that what 90% of all the movements you make from the waist up are designed to place your hands or your fingers in a certain position.
Mm.
And what 90% of all the movements you make from the waist down are designed to place your feet. And I would then, well, in the old days when I taught at Parsons, I would forbid students to draw a line from the shoulder down if they hadn't seen where that line was going to terminate, with one or two fingertips.
Okay.
See? So that to feel the movement of the arm as continuous down into the fingers, say, look at two fingers, the thumb and the index, for this. In the middle fingers, and draw right through, So when you start drawing at the shoulder, you know where its destination is. You don't start moving until you don't know where you're going. And students would be amazed at the results.
Yeah.
You know, and you can really break the fear. If you think of the hand as part of the body in continuous movement,
mm-hmm.
you break the fear. And if you do month after month, keep slicing the arm off at the wrist, you never get any further.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of teaching that I would manage to do. Sometimes when I thought the students were getting too tight, too picky, I would take the opposite tack. Stockton drawing. Do you want to hear about this?
I would love to hear about this.
Well, Stockton drawing and tell them about prehistoric cave painting. I had traveled once in southern France and looked at all these Paleolithic caves.
Mm.
And it was then generally believed, may still be true, I don't know, that these pictures were done by artist priests, perhaps done publicly before the assembled tribe, prior to a hunt, in order to somehow invoke the spirit of the beast, you know, a buffalo or mammoth or whatever they are hunting. And I said to the students, now imagine yourself as one of those Paleolithic artist priests, and you have to draw with everybody watching every movement you make. Don't move like a Swiss watchmaker, you see. Make every movement grand and stately and priestly.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think about the line you're going to put down next. And put it down when you've decided how you want the gesture to appear,
mm-hmm.
so that every line you draw is the graph for gesture you've made and the kind of gesture you want to be seen making.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would loosen the students up. See, at the end of the day, they would be amazed at the largesse and the freedom you get. So I was playing both ends.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. But as I say, in the days of abstract expressionism and of conceptual art and minimal art, these ideas and these skills had simply gone by the board.
Mm-hmm.
Although
a lot of the artists involved in these movements were trained in a classical tradition of learning to draw.
Not very much anymore.
De Kooning was.
Who was?
De Kooning.
Oh, De Kooning,
yeah.
Yes, he's exceptional. De Kooning,
mm.
absolutely. De Kooning was a great draftsman in the classical tradition.
Mm.
And Ashiel Gorky, too.
Yeah.
But Gorky was also quite exceptional in that he kept going to the Metropolitan Museum and looking at old masters. And he copied.
Mm-hmm.
That's another generation.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, no American-trained artist could draw like de Kooning.
Yeah.
If you think of Rothko or Newman or Still or any of those, that generation, or Motherwell, nobody could draw like de Kooning. None of them had that kind of background.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that in de Kooning's line,
yeah.
when he first departed from figuration and went abstract. There's marvelous white on black paintings, black on white, you know,
yeah.
black painting. There's a kind of organic vigor and elasticity to the line which comes out of his experience of life drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at that period, it was a very exciting moment when de Kooning went abstract, but those sudden flashes of figuration, like that finger with a fingernail in one of those black paintings. It was in the recent show at the Met. Anyway, I think I'm really digressing. I talked too much about this. You wanted
well,
to
I haven't
more
stopped
about
you. I've purposely not stopped you.
Now, I've told you about when I began to teach studio classes. Could you talk about your earlier training at the Slade School of Art? All I can say is that I went there during the late 1930s,
mm-hmm.
and it was the most benighted, backward place in the world. England, London, Slade School in the late 1930s, they were trying to teach academic drawing the way it might have been taught 50 years before, 100 years before. And one admired Ingres, one could still admire Degas, but people like Matisse and Picasso were sort of fly-by-nights.
Oh, yeah.
They were not taken seriously. They hardly existed in our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It was also reflected in the Tate Gallery, which was supposed to be the Museum of Modern Art at that time in London, before World War II. They owned, I think, two Picassos, Still Life of 1901, and another early one that had just been given to them. But it would never have occurred to them, to the Tate Gallery, to go after Matisse and Picasso, or Giacometti. Mm-hmm. No, Giacometti was too young then, or Mondrian.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I came to America in 1945 and walked into the Museum of Modern Art that I found a totally different world.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that was a revelation to me, I had grown up in Germany from the age of 3. I was born in Russia.
In
emigrated
Moscow.
In Moscow, yes.
Yeah.
And I was 3 and a half when I came to Germany. And as a child, I became very interested in art and German expressionist art.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a part of my consciousness.
Where were you? Were you in Munich?
In Berlin.
Berlin, okay.
Mm-hmm. So that names like Kirchner and Schmidt-Rottluff and Oskar Schlemmer and the Bauhaus were familiar to me when I was 12. In fact, I wrote my first article about art in a children's handwritten children's magazine when I was 11, I think, about Käthe Kollwitz.
Really?
And then I was taken to see her.
Were your parents involved with the art scene then? Or?
My mother told my father, who was a socialist, as Käthe Kollwitz was, to, why don't you show Leo's drawings to Käthe Kollwitz? And I remember her fairly well. We sat in a small dining room at a table, the three of us. Poor Käthe Kollwitz couldn't get a word in edgewise because my father talked all the time. I, of course, didn't say a word. I was too old. But she read my article. And as for her opinion of my drawings, she quoted Max Liebermann, who said, talents, well, I can remember the German, Talente liegen auf der Straße, es kommt auf den Charakter an. In English, talents lie about the street. It's all a matter of character. It's character that counts. In other words, she said, yes, there's talent there, but it doesn't mean a thing.
Oh.
She was absolutely right. So what I was trying to say was, close the loop I started. I knew the names and some of the work, all these people, certainly Max Beckmann,
okay,
and Glembrook, so on. And then during my 9 or 10 years in England, all this faded absolutely
mm-hmm.
from my visual field. No one in England had heard of the German Expressionists or gave a damn about them. And when I came to New York...
Why did you go to England, by the way?
Why?
Mm.
Well, it was 1933, we were Jewish, and we were
okay.
very smart to get out very early in time. This is because my parents had the experience of the Russian terror, and they recognized all the signs.
Okay.
So unlike German Jews, who had deep roots in Germany, German Jewish communities lived in Germany, thousand years since Roman times, couldn't imagine themselves moving. We were immigrants and recognized the signs of the terror and got out immediately. And it was fortunate that we went to England.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I came to New York in 1945,
mm-hmm.
the end of the war, and in the Museum of Modern Art, I remember walking in and there were two sculptures by Lehmbruck and there was a whole room of German Expressionists and all these names like Beckmann and Kirchner came flooding back to me. But London was incredibly provincial at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting during the war John Rothenstein, who was then director of the Tate Gallery, and he very proudly showed me his latest acquisitions. It's Wilson Steer, for instance. You don't know the name. Yes, well, he was a competent academic English painter. And so Wilson Steer he would buy. He wouldn't have been seen dead buying a Picasso
mm-hmm.
in the 1940s.
In the 1940s?
Yes, this was during the war. And then they changed. They were awakened after the war, but very largely, I think, under American influence.
Okay.
And it was the personality of Alfred Barr, I think, that helped to change the outlook of a whole generation. The way Roger Fry from England had changed it for an earlier generation. Roger Fry was one of the first to understand Cézanne.
And exactly.
That was the great modernism of his day. The famous show that he organized in 1913 presented Cézanne. There were, of course, one or two collectors in England, like Courtauld, who appreciated Cézanne,
mm-hmm.
but they were very much a minority. So,
which is now part of the University of London.
Yes.
And the slave school is part of the University
always
of London.
Always was.
Okay.
It's always part of University College.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was made a fellow of University College London about 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, now how does this happen? I had this idea that your alma mater, someone keeps a motherly eye over all the former students, and no matter where they scatter,
mm-hmm.
If they've done good work, then they get rewarded with a fellowship. But it turned out it wasn't quite like that. It was the doing of Lawrence Gowing,
okay.
who became director of the Slade School, and he put up my name. So, was there a person who influenced you in particular? You mean in my life generally, or?
Well, I was referring to Hunter at the time. However,
was I influenced by anybody at Hunter?
I gather not, or?
I don't think so.
Mm. How about in your lifetime? Who?
My what?
In your lifetime, who was someone who made you want to go into art history and to teach?
Excuse me.
Yes.
That's a long story, but that's purely autobiographical, and I wonder whether it's of interest in connection with Hunter College.
Probably not.
Why don't we skip it, please?
Okay. So I'm letting my curiosity get away with me.
You left the program when Doris Kennedy was chairperson. What are your memories of her and the department at the time?
So you came in with Edna Lotz, and then Jean Goosen was
mm-hmm.
there in
mm-hmm.
the middle. Then he left. And then Doris Kennedy was there.
Yes. At least he laid down the chairmanship, and Doris
yeah.
Kennedy was elected chairperson.
I ask that mainly because I'm going to be interviewing her next week, if there was any sort of...
Yes. Let's tell you... I would rather skip that question. I know that Doris Kennedy did not privilege the artists, the studio people, in the way they had been privileged by Eugene Goosen.
Mm-hmm.
And The artist tended to resent that. They thought they could maneuver her, manipulate her to continue the old policies, and found that she was too much of a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
She expected artists to put in time. And although I'd never had very much to do with her, she did say to me once or twice that she wished everybody in the department were like me in this one respect, that I never seemed to demand anything, never asked for anything.
Hmm.
I guess I didn't have the imagination to ask for anything. So some of your former students have gone on to become faculty members. Could you talk about the training of these and of other students in the art history program?
Yeah, I was thinking mostly about Lisa Vergara.
Well, I mentioned Lisa Vergara. You know, when I started teach at Hunter, it was an all-women's college. I was still tied to the Bronx campus, both, as I mentioned. They were all women. Before feminism, the young women were wonderful students. They were highly intelligent, because at that time, the City College, education was free.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a common pattern in families, middle-class families, where the boy would be sent to an Ivy League college, and that would use up as much money as they could spare for children's education, and the girl would go to Hunter, which was known to be a good college with very high standards. In fact, all the city colleges, City College and Queens, had the highest standards. But they were for people who didn't have the money to go to Smith or Radcliffe or Holyoke.
Mm-hmm.
But the standards were certainly as high, if not higher, in addition to being in New York, which always adds a certain edge of sophistication.
Mm.
And the girls, they were bright, they were interested, they were happy to be where they were proud of their college, and they were eager to please their teachers.
Sounds like a wonderful combination.
Yes, and they knew that the way to please me was to produce good work, and I got wonderful work out of them. The world changed very much. I can also remember an earlier period in my teaching career when I was teaching at Parsons School of Design, when the war veterans were coming back and they were on GI Bills. And these were young men who had just lost 2 or 3 years of their lives, given to the service of their country in the army, and they felt they had no time to waste.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked so hard, because the finest moment for any teacher in recent American history, they have students like that.
Mm-hmm.
They kept you on your toes, you have to deliver. It was great fun. But it was fun at Hunter. And then we went co-ed, and then in the late 60s, in the student rebellions, politicizing, and there were teachers who were very politically oriented, and who succeeded very quickly in polarizing a class and setting up hostile camps within the class and so on. It was the age of resentment that began then, which we still have with us.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection, it may just be an old man's fond recollections of his younger years, but my recollection is that college life was then comparatively idyllic. Except in one sense, I remember when I first came to teach at Hunter, mm-hmm. and I learned that there was a faculty cafeteria, I thought what a boon this was going to be, that I should be able to meet with people in other departments and listen to informed conversations of biologists and physicists and economists and all the areas in which I'm totally ignorant. And I discovered very soon that all the conversation was gossip, all about problems of tenure and appointment, and there was nothing there that I wanted to listen to. And I stopped going to the faculty cafeteria, except when I had student conferences. I would invite one or two mm-hmm. students at the cafeteria. We had no offices, of course. I don't know if they have offices now.
They do.
They do
have offices now.
In the days of my teaching at Hunter, you had to talk to a student, you had to do it in the hallways.
So the building that the art department is now wasn't built until just recently.
So now art historians have offices?
They do.
Yeah. Yes. I didn't even have a desk, not so much as a drawer.
Cool.
In those days.
Now, did you have a slide library, a resource, or did you bring your own slides?
There was a slide library, which was constantly being raided. Things were being stolen from it. That was a terrible problem. It was a great headache to Goosen, because he had to fork up the money to pay for slides. But I made my own slides from the beginning, when I was a student. And I was very poor. This was one thing I wouldn't scrimp on. I knew I would be depending on slides, and I started building my own slide collection from my student days. Mm-hmm. So when I began to teach, I would supplement them, slides from the library, but most of it I would do with my own.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have them? Do you still
I have them? Tens of thousands of slides. When I made my will, I wasn't quite sure what to do with them. I have some former students who are teaching. Kathy Santora teaches at Kratt. I indicated in my will to my executors that former students of mine who are teaching should have a choice of slides. Paula Harper, I remember my first conference with her standing up in the hallway at Hunter. She had been a dancer, had decided that this was not going to be her career, she was not quite fitted for it, and she wanted to take art history, but wondered whether she wasn't too old.
Mm-hmm.
I forget whether she was 29 or 31 or something. Anyway, I told her that I started at 35, and I encouraged her because she seemed very bright,
mm-hmm.
and she went through Hunter and took a PhD at Stanford, and been a full professor at the University of Miami for many years. I have many former students who teach.
Yeah.
Some of them have become artists. In fact, there's one woman who went to Canada, married, raised a family, but continued to work as an artist. And about a year ago, she sent me the catalog of an exhibition that she dedicated to me, because she remembered my teaching.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's a wonderful talk.
On the other hand, I was approached by a group of three people, elderly or middle-aged, I should say, well into middle age, at the Metropolitan Museum one day, not long ago, and a woman introduced herself as a former student of mine at Hunter. She said she had recently met with two other friends, who she still sees from her days at Hunter, and they were talking about my classes. And then she said to me, and we decided, do you know what you were doing in those classes? I kind of blanched, thinking, oh my God, what was I doing? She said, you were casting pearls before swine.
Oh no.
And she said that it took them 20 years to realize what I'd been giving them. So if that is true, then perhaps I was talking over people's heads. And no wonder that many students would resist taking my courses. Because apparently I had a reputation of having too high standards and being intimidating. That's where my old moralism came in. When a student turned in a paper, I would not let anything that was wrong, whether in punctuation or grammar or spelling or structure or ideas or facts, nothing that I thought needed to comment would pass.
Now this is the day before computers, so they mm-hmm. had typed them all out.
Yes,
so.
Some were even handwritten papers. And I read every word, knowing perfectly well that 9/10 of the students probably wouldn't bother to read my comments. But I still did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued to do it until I retired. No wonder I was happy to retire.
That's pretty time consuming.
Yes. I must have put in thousands of hours annotating student papers.
Well, you were doing it for the 1/10 that actually...
For what?
You were doing it for the 1/10 of the students who actually...
Yes, and in a strange metaphysical way, I was doing it for the profession itself. This is what the job requires. This is what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is read now or not is not my concern, but this is what I have to do. And I remember from my childhood, I had a history teacher when I was about 13 or 14. I remember having to write a paper on the grab for Africa. It's about European colonialism.
Oh, okay.
In the 19th century. And I just learned the word pugnacious. I was dying to get it in. And so I referred to one of the tribes that were being subdued by the new Maxim gun. I think it was the first machine gun just invented. I referred to one of the tribes in Africa as pugnacious. And the teacher wrote in the margin, no more so than any other people deprived of their land. And I remember this to this day, because I knew that I'd thrown in the word pugnacious because I wanted to use a fancy word and impress her.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really thought through
yeah.
what it meant. She didn't know my motives. She saw the word pugnacious and corrected me, and I've never forgotten that correction. This, when you asked before who influenced me,
mm-hmm.
The answer is Miss Hyatt. 13 or 14 years old, gave me a sense that you don't use words unless you mean them
mm-hmm.
and know what they mean and what you mean by them. So certain lessons stick if they come at the right time.
Yeah.
Well, what else would you like to know? Are there more questions here? I had no involvement with the Hunter Gallery and student exhibitions whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Then I see a question, what is your philosophy about teaching art history and how did it evolve at Hunter College?
Since it was your first.
Pardon?
Since it was your first formal art history.
Yes.
After the
philosophy is a rather highfalutin term. I'm not sure I had a philosophy or anything that dignified it. Okay. But I can tell you, for instance, since I prefer specifics, there's the question of dates. there are many things that, failings that people will not admit. No one, for instance, will say that I'm a very ungenerous person. You never hear anybody say that. You never hear anybody deny that they are sensitive, you know. Of course, everybody thinks they're very sensitive. But there are certain failings that people boast of, like, I have no memory for dates. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, you never hear anybody say, I have a very good memory for dates. That would type them as being kind of pedantic and unimaginative. Mm-hmm. Totally wrapped up in mere dry facts. So I would hear students tell me they have no memory for dates. I just don't have a head for it. You might find out that these same students can remember 100 different telephone numbers, and they may remember 1,000 different batting averages for favorite baseball players, but they have no memory for dates. And I recall once a student gave a report on anger. And every other sentence she said, and at this time he was doing, and at this time he was doing, and finally I interrupted and said, what time is this now? Well, she says, I don't remember the exact date. So I said, well, how old is Andrew now? She was a little baffled. I said, come on, is he a young rebel now, announcing that his masters had betrayed him? Or is he a crusty old establishment figure who's appalled by these insolent newcomers like Courbet? Doesn't that make a difference? I was trying to get across to them that dates translate into the real life situation. Mm-hmm. And then I remember doing this. There was a young man in the class who had told me the week before that he was about to be married. I congratulated him. He was probably 20 or 21. And I think I knew the girl he was marrying. She was also a student. She was probably the same age. Well, the next week, quite casually, the question of dates came up. I managed to say, by the way, this George, whatever his name was, you may have heard that he's about to be married. And then I turned to him and said, you said your wife was 42? And you should have seen his jaw drop. He blanched. Such a look of horror on his face. And then I laughed and I said, did you see what just happened? See? And obviously the girl he's marrying is 20. See? I said 42. What does that mean? It means that instead of being born in 1960 or 1940, he was born in 1960. See, that's what dates mean.
Yeah.
It's a matter of, you know, understanding a life situation. And for a contemporary artist, it would make a hell of a difference to him whether the work that he had produced at age, if this artist is now 60, if a work that he had produced at 25 or at 15 were misdated. It would destroy the whole trajectory of his life's work. That's what dates are about.
Mm-hmm.
So I would sometimes do that in my teaching, to try to make them understand that there's a certain dignity in what they think is mere pedantry.
Mm-hmm.
You're not talking about anything. You're not talking about a human being if you simply say anger at this time and you don't understand the difference between anger at 20 and at 60. But as for my... I mean, I've always loved art. I've loved art since I was 3 or 4 years old. And I thought that this was a way of sharing, in a way justifying my own life, and giving young people something which would keep them somehow enriched for all of their lives, because education is the one thing that can't be taken away from you. It can't be undone. And if I taught a course in Mantegna, whom I dearly love, he's my favorite painter. And Mantegna has had, in part, a bad press. Yeah. People think of him as very dry and stiff and so on. If I can get them really excited about Mantegna and show what a sense of humor the man had, and the kind of deep wit, mm-hmm. and the self-consciousness with which he approaches art. Clement Greenberg thinks that self-consciousness about art making is a modern innovation, and that the old masters were just copying appearances. Well, there is far deeper self-consciousness about what he is doing in Mantegna mm-hmm. than there is in abstract expressionism. So if I can get that across, and make people realize that to look at one work, certain works, not any work, but if you look at one work by a master like Mantegna or Velázquez for an hour or 2 hours, you can be as richly entertained as watching TV for 2 hours. Because as Tom Hess used to say, it takes years to look at a picture. And if you don't know what there is in a really great painting to be seen, and what the rewards of seeing that are, then you're just missing so much of the world. Now,
it's
I'm perfectly aware that
eye.
This is... Pardon?
It's called having an eye. Having an eye.
Yes. It is, of course, true of any field. The person who really understands flowers or trees or the human body, the way a scientist understands it, the person who really understands physics, all these people are deeply enamored of their material. And I'm ignorant of most of these fields, but I can be deeply fascinated to see how infinitely open every area of human interest can be, depending on the mind that does the investigating.
Mm-hmm.
And I have chosen the field of art, because I find it interesting. So, I don't know whether that constitutes a philosophy of art or not, but you had better talk to my former students to get an answer to that question. Now then, you asked, you were involved in the forming of the art history PhD program at the Graduate Center with Milton Brown. How did the idea evolve? The original idea, it was, I don't remember it exactly, but I think Eugene Goossen also had formulated this notion that there were two great art history departments in New York, the NYU Institute and Columbia. Of course, art history was also being taught at Ford and other places, but these were the two main institutions. And they both had enormous libraries and large faculties, and were doing a very good job, except for three areas. And those three areas were American art, which was hardly taken seriously.
Yeah.
It's only beginning, and Milton Brown was a pioneer in the field. So American art and modern art, which is certainly not taken seriously, there was no modernist. Modern art was considered a field for journalism, but not for serious study.
Okay.
And again, it was Alfred Barr who gradually changed that. He, for the first time, introduced the idea that when you do a show of contemporary art, you do a catalogue with the same scientific and scholarly rigor that you would bring to an old master show.
Mm-hmm.
This had never been done before. And Bach was trained in art history. I think originally meant to write his dissertation on Paulo Iulo. He never did. Did you know that?
I didn't.
But Alfred Bauer always respected history of art.
He was at Princeton, wasn't he?
Pardon?
He was at Princeton for his story.
Yes. So I think taught for a while, I think at Vassar.
He was at Vassar, yeah.
Anyway, he was a pioneer in this, but it had not yet percolated to the Institute of Fine Arts. When I was a student at the Institute in the middle 50s, I began to write contemporary art criticism, and I kept it silent, quiet. I didn't want any of the faculty to know. And my image was like a respectable woman who does sleepwalking at night. She doesn't want anyone to know about it. See? So, and the faculty found out about it at the College Art Association meeting when I was awarded the prize, the Mather citation for the best criticism of the year. Then they suddenly learned that I'd been writing, that I'd been looking at contemporary art and writing about the Kooning and Pollock and so on the side. Because respectable art historians were supposed to have their noses in Bernini or...
But it must have been irresistible.
Pardon?
It must have been irresistible being in New York City when all
this
was going on.
Well, resistible to a few. The other student, my fellow student, my generation, who was doing the same thing, was Robert Rosenblum. He, of course, was specializing in 18th and 19th century art, so the leap was not so great. I made a larger leap because I was coming from Renaissance and Baroque.
Okay.
To modern, but I was always going to contemporary shows and going down to the club. A colleague of mine at Penn said to me some years ago, he had also been a student at the Institute, he said, you know, in those days in the 1950s, did you ever used to go down to the club? You know what the club was?
Yes, yes.
And I said, yes. So I remember Klein and Franz Klein and de Kooning talking and so on. He said, you know, I had a friend who was always asking me to go down, but I thought, yeah, it's a waste of time, so he never did. And now, he says, one of his students is writing a dissertation on the club. But in a way, he was quite characteristic. He didn't think keeping up with this contemporary world as part of his job as a training to be an art historian. But I began to write about it, and then Bob wrote about it, and of course he's remained and become involved with contemporary art to this day, much more than I, because I pulled back from it completely.
Mm-hmm.
But he also married a contemporary artist. He once told me, helps to keep his hand in. Why did I digress into this? Oh, yes, the Graduate Center. Well, the Graduate Center, the idea was that there were three areas in which these great art history departments of Columbia and the Institute were not pulling their weight.
Mm-hmm.
And they were American art, modern art, and criticism. And New York was, of course, the place for that. It was the center of art criticism, it was the center of contemporary art, and to some extent, certainly representative also American art, although 19th century American art is more diffused.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, the idea was then to start the graduate program in these three areas. And since we could start it in the new Graduate Center,
mm-hmm.
which Minervis had founded, and it happened to be across the street from the New York Public Library, we would make special arrangements for our students to work there,
yeah.
So we wouldn't have we wouldn't need the millions and millions, which we could never get, to build a library to compete with the great established artistry departments. It seemed very reasonable. And so, somehow, the powers that be were persuaded that this was a good, workable idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started with 10 students. And I remember teaching the first 10 students being enrolled.
When was that? It was 71, I think.
Something like that. And I didn't get an appointment at the Graduate Center because Milton Brown, who was chairman, pointed out, he says, we don't need to appoint you because we've got you. You're at Hunter. You're within the city system. See? The only appointment they made was the late John Rewald,
okay,
who was then commuting to Chicago and was very happy he had his place here. And it was all right, except that John Rewald didn't prepare lectures. He would sit and sort of reminisce, talk about his experiences and, as an art historian. And I'm sure the students got a lot out of it, but there were jam sessions. Well, that's how that started. And I taught only modern courses there, because at that time we were not supposed to teach general art history.
Mm-hmm.
The students, insofar as the students at the Graduate Center were supposed to have some background in art history, they would take the courses at Hunter or Queens,
yeah,
or whatever. And the only courses I taught there were in criticism, method, and I think Picasso.
Now, I have heard Milton Brown gave a interview for the Archives of American Art that I read, and he said there was a bit of trouble starting up the art history department because it was approved as a course and then the funding was cut back.
Mm-hmm.
It was approved as a department, and then funding was on hold. But David Rockefeller spoke to his brother Nelson Rockefeller and said art history is a needed part of the Graduate Center and you need to keep it on.
Hmm.
So despite budget cuts, the Graduate Center Art History Department stayed on. I don't know if you've heard that.
No, I have not heard that.
Yeah.
Well, Milton would know this. But I was married during the 1960s. And my wife, Dorothy Seiberling, she had been the head of the art department, Life magazine.
Mm.
She had a place in West Hampton. And when Milton and I got together on this project for the Graduate Center, Dorothy and I invited Milton and Blanche, his wife, for a weekend. And during that weekend, we drew up the program.
Hmm.
But the politics and the financing of it is something I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
I have all through my life managed to steer clear of any administrative positions, of any committee work, of any involvement in financing or fundraising. And I don't feel that I've missed anything.
Hmm. Also at the University of Pennsylvania as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Gregorian, Barton Gregorian, you've heard the name.
Yes.
He was provost at, first dean of humanities and then provost at University of Pennsylvania when I came in, and when he came to New York to become president of the New York Public Library, we had lunch one day and I asked him, Greg, tell me honestly, weren't you disappointed in me when I came to Penn You expected me to somehow vitalize the department and do things, and which I didn't do. And he said, frankly, at the beginning, yes. But then I realized what you were doing, and I understood that my only obligation to you was to leave you alone. And he said, you may have noticed that you were never asked to serve on any committee. He said, because whenever your name was proposed to serve on a committee, I would say, no, leave Stanford alone, he has other things to do. That, by the way, is, I think, a mark of Gregorian's genius as an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
He understood what people's talents were and how to use them and not to waste them.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are very good at committee work who will love it, and they should be doing it. Well, is that about it?
That's about it. If there was anything you wanted to add, if there was any particular particular story or particular memory that you had that you felt was important to add to the history of Honduras.
I tell you one story that I kind of cherish. This is very early in my teaching career at Hunter, and I was teaching at the Bronx campus, now Lehman College. There was a young man who sat at the back of the class just listening, not taking notes, and he was auditing. And I paid no attention to him because he was not part of the class, but I had no objection to anyone sitting in it who was interested. There was also a very bright young woman who was always shooting her mouth off. She liked to hear her own voice. And sometimes saying very silly things. I was showing a Raphael painting of St. Catherine. It's a very beautiful painting. St. Catherine, with one hand over her breast and the other hand resting rather tenderly on the wheel of her martyrdom. This girl raises her hand and says, Professor Steinbeck, why is it that Catherines always have such particularly delicate hands? I've noticed that. Well, I was totally baffled by this question. So I said to her, well, I think there are certain things you have to do before you are ready to ask that question. First thing I suggest, you bring together at random 100 pictures of St. Catherine and make sure that the generalization really holds.
Mm-hmm.
They have particularly delicate hands. Then I suggest as a control you bring together 100 pictures of St. Barbara and see whether they have the comparison dishpan hands. And if you find that it holds your observation, then you are ready to ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of that semester, a month or so later, this young man who had always been sitting at the back of the class came over to me and said he was a science major. And he always thought that art, when people involved in art, was sort of romantic, daydreaming, undisciplined, subjective,
mm-hmm.
so on, the very opposite of what is required of an hard-headed scientist. And he would sit in my classes expecting to have this notion or prejudice confirmed. And he said, there was one moment when I suddenly realized that I was stupid. He said, this was nothing but a prejudice. And that was the time when you answered that question about St. Catherine's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that your mind works just the way any scientist does.
Mm.
And that's one of those moments in my teaching career that I remember.
Mm. Did he go on to become an art historian?
For the scientist?
Yes.
I hope not. He'd be out of a job now, wouldn't he?
Much safer in science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well.
Well, that's.
Now, what are you going to do with this? Listen to who's going to type it up? You?
I get to type it up.